Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Welcome to Needle Exchange, conversations on the art of thread. I'm Jamie Chalmers, aka Mr. X-Stitch, and today I'm interviewing Lauren Batt. Lauren is an American-born artist who's made France her home for decades. In this first half of our conversation, we trace her path from linguistics and art history into printmaking. I nearly said linguini, it's true. Then we make the leap into her layered, tapestry-like paintings and quilted figures that are inspired by guild traditions, street life in New York, and medieval folk energy. If you haven't seen Lauren's work already, be sure to check her out on Instagram. Follow the links in the show description for that. We talk about bilingual identity, raising globally mobile kids, and the moment canvas stopped being invisible support and became living textile, complete with stitched frames and characters stepping out into relief. Lauren's conversation somewhat reminded me of chatting with Owen Kelly, whose folk-inspired art has a raw charm that's not a million miles from how Lauren's work makes me feel. I chatted with him in episodes 88 and 89, so be sure to find those. He's a great guy. If you enjoy this conversation, make sure you subscribe on your podcasting platform so you don't miss part two, which will be coming next week. But for now, enjoy the show. So currently then you live in France.
Yeah, I do.
Where you've lived for quite a long time. So yeah, I'm just like, so I looked at your CV on your website and you've traveled around the world quite a bit. Let me get this right. Your mother is of Swedish descent. Your father is of Parisian origin. So I guess...
My father was American and from British background.
Oh, okay. Did he live in Paris then or something?
No, my mother did when she was a kid.
Right.
When she was just a little kid.
Right, okay. So then you're born in the States.
Yeah.
But before you know it, you traverse the globe about 100 times.
Well, rewind to my mother.
Let's do it properly.
The Swede who started growing up in Paris, she was the one who made the original crossing. Mm-hmm. After World War II,
right.
She wanted to escape from, even though Sweden wasn't invaded by the Nazis, they had that fear throughout the war and they were rationed and, you know, it was a grim time. Mm. She was 19. She wanted to travel the world. She got her hands on a rare visa that was being given out at the time to come to the States, and she went. And dumped an au pair job pretty quickly.
Right.
Settled in the Philadelphia area where she got a job. And then she met my dad there. Mm-hmm. And they ended up getting married. And she settled down and had kids. And so she made that first cultural jump.
Right.
And she kept telling us about how she had started off her life in Paris, where her Swedish parents went in the 20s. They met there, actually. And then she took us to Sweden for a couple of summers. And so I pretty early on was bitten by the travel bug and by the idea of Europe. I really liked our experiences there. Mm. And then I went back before I met my husband, mm-hmm, to France for various reasons. I studied a bit in Europe, mm, and then finished my studies in Washington, where I met my husband,
right,
who's French.
Okay.
And I followed him back.
So despite going to France a lot, you met him over on this side.
In the States, exactly. Yeah.
It was fated.
And after that, it was just back and forth and back and forth, mm, because of his job.
Yeah.
And then looking at your geography, then Latin America also plays quite a big part, or seems to have been, because you've been there on several occasions.
On a couple. Mm. But when you say occasions, usually, because I don't know if I should say it now, but my husband's job as a journalist, working for a wire service, meant that we would go for, like, on average 4 years
right.
at a time. So we actually lived in...
That's more than an occasion, isn't it, really? Yeah.
Yeah. So we lived in Costa Rica for 4 years in Central America. And then one of his last postings was to Uruguay, because he was directing the whole of South America for his wire service. And it ended up playing a really big role in terms of my work specifically. Yeah.
I mean, because I spoke to someone recently as well who because of her parents, she'd moved around the world quite a lot. It wasn't like an army situation, but it wasn't dissimilar to that. And there's this, a sense of identity, and then also how easily you sort of assimilate into places and how deeply you assimilate into places. And I'm curious about that from your standpoint, because a bit like with Kirsty, it feels like maybe you've got a bit more of a sort of global sensibility about you rather than necessarily being, I mean, I know you are American and I know you've lived in America and all that, but it feels like the world is quite a small place for you.
I'm not very jaded that way. I'm still pretty naive because I did really grow up in America.
Right.
So I was not a diplomat or an army brat, you know, moving throughout my childhood. So I definitely have roots there.
Mm.
And I would say that my kids are more flexible that way. Because I arrived in France almost 50 years ago.
Right.
And there's been a lot of coming and going, like I said, but still I spent really a good many years here and I've had to adapt and I've learned the codes and I kind of, you know, I know how to be French, but I still, after all this time, I don't feel French.
Mm. Do you ever dream in French?
Good question. I probably do, but not often.
Okay.
And I, you know, and I speak to myself all the time, but in English.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and I struggle with the language. I speak French well, but I still, you know, there's the whole business with gender and idiomatic expressions and things. There are a lot of things that I just don't have access to that my kids do. Mm. My kids have that flexibility. So I think... it's a bit of a question of, you know, I think we carry a lot of baggage with us from our childhood and where we grew up and, you know, all of the kind of trivial pursuit influences that we absorb during childhood.
Yeah, because then you said about your children as well, and I was struck by the way that you got two sons, is that right?
I've got two sons.
And they both went to uni. But one went to Bordeaux and the other one went to Montreal. just gone to the different corners of the world, scattered like the wind or something.
I can't drive to see the Montrealer on the weekends. It's true. They did and had absolutely no problem sort of setting up their own lives in these new places.
I was going to say, but like when I moved here, I've met a lot of people who sort of live in the same towns that they've grown up with. And some of them even live in the same houses that they grew up in. I know two people who've bought their houses off their parents. And it's just fascinating the different perspectives. Like I haven't traveled a ton, but I mean, me and my wife and my kids have moved up the country. Like Flora, my youngest, is now living in her fifth house and she's 8. But we've lived in this one for quite a while. We bounced quite a lot fairly early on for her. In fact, it got to us spending 2 years in the house that we currently live in. And she was like, shouldn't we have moved by now? And we were like, no, this is nice. We're going to stay here. Whatever. But you know, like just,
this one.
Yeah. I'm not going anywhere. That it's just that world perspective. It's the interesting thing that I've been struck by here. And it's not, I'm not doing those people a disservice because they're really happy. And this is a place where people seem to stay for a long time. But it's interesting the perspectives you get and the cultural influences that you can take. I would imagine your children must have such broad horizons just from their experiences all over the place.
I think they do. One of my sons, the one who stayed in France or who moved back to France to go to university, at one point he said that we had moved around so much that he was happy just kind of staying in one place now at this point. And since then he's moved a few times. So, but that was a reflection of his. At the same time, with what I find fascinating is that, you know, moving around is one thing, moving between languages is another. And I find that I started learning French in high school and then I dropped it because I couldn't figure out what I was going to use it for. And then I started studying again when I came back to France during a gap year before university. So it is a second language, and I have a different personality in French because I can't sort of make the same.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Humor might happen. You can't make jokes happen the same way. You know, there's always this little bit of me that's struggling when I speak French. And my kids don't have that. And it's really interesting to me because I think they have the same personality in both languages.
Are they sort of more French native?
I wouldn't say so, although they did go through the French school system.
Right.
No matter where we lived, the French had this great system set up all over the world where, you know, if you move from one country to another and you go to a French lycée, you're going to get the same program. So it's very consistent, but now they just have this flexibility. You know, we lived in the States for 6 years with them and they were perfectly American when they were there. But then they went to the French school and were perfectly French at the French school.
I remember
They really go back and forth.
Yeah. It's that like 37 words for snow sort of thing, isn't it? I remember a long time ago, you know, the language that you grew up in is the social construct that is placed upon you. Otherwise you could just be feral. And I guess when you have different languages and some of those languages are able to express certain modalities more than others, that gives you that freedom. So you maybe, I'm just pondering on, you know, you've started with American English and then potentially been constrained by French, whereas they started with French and then English just gives them another layer. But then you were also in South America. So were you learning the languages there?
Yeah, right. Spanish.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I always spoke English to my kids. So they grew up bilingual from the start. And when we lived in Costa Rica, we went there when they were babies. So they had more of an Anglophone, Hispanic experience there. And then we moved back to France when they started grade school, elementary school. And then, you know, the French had to really kick in and but develop.
And that's building like their neural pathways, isn't it? That's what's bonkers is it's like literally their brains are forming.
Smart.
Yeah.
They're very flexible. Yeah, that's the...
Yeah, that's really nice, isn't it? It's really kind of open-minded in some ways. It's slightly the exact opposite of what I was saying about my friends living in their parents' houses. I've got one friend and I do like him and he's a good guy, but he's got a sister who lives in the same village. And then he's got another sister who might live about half an hour away, but he doesn't really see her very much.
No.
And you're just like, you don't see your son very much because he lives in Canada, like the other side of the world. It's just like, Oh, bless them. I feel like we probably ought to talk about textiles, really, because I'm sure people listening to this are like, this is great. Is there anything to do with textiles? First of all, congratulations on a second place win, Mr. X Stitch Contemporary. Your work's so charming. I was struck by another thing on your bio where you said when you were a child, people would ask you what you wanted to be, and you said you wanted to be an illustrator and a toy maker. And gosh darn it, you've held on to that. I'm fascinated by that.
Yeah, it wasn't necessarily by any intention of mine in the intervening years. I was just always fascinated by these. My mother had these amazingly beautiful illustrated Swedish books with they were all about trolls, and not the little plastic fad trolls that I grew up with, but these real
kind of ones that turn into stones in the daytime, those kind of ones.
Exactly. And I love those books, and I loved my toys, and I loved, you know, everything. I loved making things. Not with any serious intention, but it was definitely a part of my imagination. So I think I was 10 when we moved out of one house to another, and I had to switch schools, and they made me do this psychological evaluation. And the last question on that test was, what do you want to be when you grow up? And that was my answer. And despite a few detours along the way, it's kind of where I've ended up.
Was there ever any, because you studied language and linguistics, didn't you, when you did your, which is interesting, let's just say, given the front end of our conversation, almost like we planned it. But yeah, then you went on and you studied in Paris, and you studied painting and conservation and print and that kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
The artistic, that was always the intention, remained. It never really got sideswiped.
Yeah, it was woken up by the fact that I did meet my future husband at the time in Washington, D.C. We were both at uni, as you say. Not the same uni, but we lived in the same house. We were housemates. And I just, you know, I fell in love. I followed him back to France. You could do that in those days and have no plan, no idea what you were going to do when you got there. And since I didn't have any kind of immigration status, I had no work papers, it sort of pushed me almost by chance to fall back on what it was that I really loved, which was making art. And at the time, I really wanted to learn printmaking. That was my thing. And so that's what I went into. And I had, before that, I would just say, when I was studying at university, you know, in the American system, you generally have two initial years where you can study a wide variety of subjects before you concentrate on your major. So I did study a lot of art history, and that was very important for me too. It was always in the background. I always had in my mind influences from artists from way back, you know, in medieval Renaissance times through to modern art. And that also pushed me over into the art world in Paris.
Right. Yeah, I guess you can kind of see it actually when you look at, because I want to talk about character development later, because you've clearly got a style and you clearly have this world that you've built. But there is that medieval feeling about it. It sort of reminds me, I had a conversation a while ago about early or certain types of tarot cards and the kind of the aesthetic that was presented. And how in some ways that was quite an emergent thing, because it was like the 1800s, you know, this is like pre-Art Nouveau and all those sorts of things. So there's that, like with yours, there is a folk art vibe. There is this sort of medieval charm about it. Is that, do you think that was triggered by that kind of the art history, seeing things that really resonated with you?
Yeah, Absolutely. I mean, I was, you know, kind of fascinated by the whole idea of artists working in guilds and working on these projects together. And it was at the same time slow art. That's why I was originally attracted to printmaking, because it was anyway a slow art. Now it's evolved so much, but the kind of printmaking that I learned with actual engraving and various other techniques was very slow and very much influenced by my imagination of what it would have been like to work in a printmaking guild studio in the medieval days. Or
I mean, it is bonkers. Like, it's like me a dumb sounding thing, but I said it to someone the other day, like, it's bonkers to think that once upon a time there hadn't been a Caxton print. Once upon a time every single book you've read had been like handwritten by someone. Do you know what I mean? We take that
some Irish monk. Yeah.
Honestly, for like days, and maybe they got a little bit bored, so they decided to draw some people arguing in the corner of the page or something, just to lighten up the day. Like, we take it so for granted, don't we? And even like you say, even then, the early print methods would have still been fairly like time consuming.
Yeah, absolutely. Traditional techniques, very slow.
So you studied illustration. Like, when did you start to like build this world then? Where did these characters, have they always been? Has it always been this way? Or, without sounding wrong, have you gotten steadily weirder over the years?
Definitely choice B. Well, I don't know how it is for other people other artists you've interviewed, but I know that early on, especially with the study of art history, your mind is sort of chock-a-block full of the work of other artists. And it can be a bit of a struggle to find yourself in there. And, you know, you're kind of dragging out pieces of Botticelli and Picasso and whatever, and mixing it all up. And it may not be very coherent. I did have one sort of personal influence that was important to me, and that was my grandfather, my Swedish grandfather, who is better known as a composer, but he did paint as well, especially in his younger years. He had to give it up at one point because he chose music, but he had a very, his name was Gösta Nyström, and he had a very personal style. And it was like, he did a lot of painting. He spent some years in Copenhagen, and he would go out in the street and paint what he saw, but with a kind of narrative Scandinavian, slightly gloomy style, very graphic. And I loved his work, and I thought, well, this is, you know, this gives me permission to also just go out and look around me and pay attention to what I see and use that in my work, in my own work. I don't have to do Picasso. I don't have to do anyone else. I can do what I see. So that started off when I was still printmaking. And then we moved back to the States, and we lived in New York for 3.5 years or so. And New York was just mind blowing in its own. And talk about street life, and, you know, just seeing, going out, walking in the streets and seeing the most amazing things happen and the most amazing faces, and any, you know, stand on any street corner and you have this tableau in front of you. So that sort of helped me take that idea of just looking around me and recording human life, street life, in my work. I was going to say that also corresponded to a time I was also printmaking in New York, but I sort of slowly moved. Since it was so slow, I was beginning to get frustrated. And so I moved towards making monoprints with the idea of bringing the sort of main characters, printing them separately and then cutting them out and bringing them out in front of the print in relief.
Right.
And then from there, eventually to just straight up painting, but with the same idea of bringing the main characters out in front of the background support in kind of relief, giving layers to the visual aspect of the work.
And is that because, is that like a way of storytelling in that case, and like deliberately, because I guess there are other ways you can make characters stand out, but by the decision to like bring them forward to create another dimension.
Absolutely. Because when I would walk around and observe street life, it just was so apparent to me how many layers of it there were. Mm. And for me, and including things that you don't see necessarily, you know, the past and what's underground. And so it was just kind of a natural progression to fit those layers into the work and into the painting as well. Mm. And one of the satisfying things for me meant that it turned, for me, a painting, which we tend to consider as a piece of canvas stretched on a stretcher, and then sort of gessoed until the texture has been sublimated, really, it disappears. It becomes just a support for the paint. Mm. But in layering it, I could have one layer of canvas behind, another layer in front with some parts kind of torn out as if it was a piece of paper, and then more people up in front that are quilted. And it maintains the textile quality of the support. In other words, I am painting on a textile, not on this invisible kind of pretend solid surface. Mm. It's actual fabric. Canvas is fabric.
Right. Yeah. And I was going to say earlier, like I'm always fascinated by like the beauty in the mundane, like when you look around and you just stop and like you say, because life happens in all shapes and sizes. And most of the time we just got our heads focused on the ground and we're just not really paying attention to it. But there is something I like to take photos on my phone. I've got this Game Boy camera emulator, which is like Game Boy did a camera and it turns all the pictures into little squares, which then makes it quite cross-stitch accessible.
Oh, wow, yeah.
But there's something about like the low res of the technology, which reminds me of old film photography where you took your chances and sometimes the faces weren't quite right. But I think now there's a nostalgic beauty in that. And I guess in some ways, like your work doesn't do that explicitly, because then you have this, is it like an absurd layer? I don't know how you describe the layer that you place on top of it, the character, but there's still a sort of normality that you build as well.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Hopefully.
I'm trying to think of the word in French. There's a word décalé, which means, you're kind of a bit, there's part of it that's a bit off center.
Yeah. Like a bit wonky.
Yeah. A bit wonky. Yeah, that's intentional. Mm. But it's also the idea, I don't know. There are a lot of things that kind of came together at once when I started painting. And they were all sort of in reaction to an allergy to these preset geometrical formats that are often used in painting. And at the same time, you know, mixed in with all that, living in France, I've gone to visit, well, living in France, New York, Washington, traveling to London, you know, you go to museums and there's no better school than going to an outstanding museum and just looking what other people have done through the ages. But also in castles, they have these tapestries, huge, beautiful tapestries hanging on the walls. And I was always so enamored of these tapestries and the textile quality of them. And I realized at one point after the nth person asked me, you know, if they bought a painting, they would say, how should I frame it? And I had no idea because I'm not a good decorator. I'm no good with framing. And I thought, well, I should make my own frames. Mm. I should incorporate my own frames onto the painting so that nobody has to frame it.
Mm.
And also, they could look more like tapestries if I don't stretch them on a stretcher. I can stretch them, the canvas on the wall to paint it, and then take it off and sew these edges, these frame edges around. And that also gives me the possibility of sewing these foreground characters that are quilted onto the front, and then hang it like a tapestry so that it's somewhere in some world between painting and textile tapestry work.
Mm.
I didn't weave anything, I have to admit.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, then you're in diorama territory as well, aren't you? Because I guess then you start to add the additional layers.
From there came the idea that, yeah, canvas is fabric. You can do all kinds of things with fabric. So why not work it in three dimensions? Instead of having, you know, a flat painting, while you sew the canvas like you're sewing a doll,
mm-hmm.
and stuff it, put a little bit of armature in there. And then there's always a layer of acrylic medium to sort of stiffen the surface and then paint on that. So that's what I did. And the diorama aspect, sometimes they're freestanding. Sometimes I like to put them in scenes. And that goes way back to school days.
Right.
When we were sometimes, you know, we would study like in history, maybe prehistory, and we were asked to make these dioramas in shoeboxes. Mm. Where you could, you know, you would recreate a scene with dinosaurs made out of Play-Doh and and you could put sand in the bottom for the ground. And I love doing that. I love doing that kind of thing when I was a kid. Stuck. So it stuck. It stuck.
Yeah. And then, like, because you've got a certain style, again, which I think reminds me of that sort of medieval vibe, the cheekiness of the faces, and yet there's quite a distinct look to your characters. Was that something that happened fairly early on, or has that been something you've kind of deliberately evolved over time? Because I'm reminded, I always think of Audrey Montoya. I talk about her all the time. She does needle felted characters. Usually, like lately, she's been doing slices of pizza, but she always puts glass eyes in them. There's always a certain poignancy about them. They're just weird in all the right ways, and it's very much the stuff that Audrey was put on the planet to make. And I can't escape the feeling that you're making the work you were put on the planet to make. So I'm trying to understand whether that's like you found that voice early, or whether you've deliberately evolved your characters over time.
That's so nice to hear that I was put on the planet.
Well, you seem to, because you seem to be pretty early on. You were like, this is what I'm going to be. And bless you, you're still being that thing. So I wanted to be a coach driver, and look at me now. I'm not sure what that means, but
never too late. Never too late.
Yeah.
A gallery owning coach driver is,
yeah, why not?
Really good on your resume. I would say that it's been around for a long time.
Mm.
I did. There was a point when I was in my teens that I wanted to be a marionettist.
Right.
And I actually did during that gap year between high school and college. I lived with my sister for a few months in Vermont. We were in the middle of the forest in a kind of a cabin behind a sleazy motel. Mm-hmm. And there was this marionette class in the town nearby. And we both went. And the goal was to create a Christmas play for the town. And I ended up making all the marionettes. Because I loved doing it. And then, and you know, we all wrote the scripts and everyone had their part. And we put on this show And as much as, you know, doing something like this or putting myself out in front of the world is tough for me, it makes me really nervous. Mm. Behind the marionette, it was just magical. Mm. I had no problem letting, so I definitely took over the show. And so that's always been there. And I can't forget either that later on, I started making life-size people out of stockings. I did a whole setup of my family in a sauna in the nude. I don't know why. It was their Christmas present one year. And then later on, when we moved to back to Washington and New York, I made these life-size people that went into store windows.
Yeah. I've seen a photo of one of those. Was it a butcher's I saw a picture of?
A bookstore.
Right. Or was there a butcher? Or am I imagining that? There was someone, I think maybe a man in an apron or something. I feel like that was what I saw. Don't quote me.
No, I'll look through my archives. I may have forgotten that one. I had a couple in a bookstore. It was a language bookstore.
Oh, I think, or there's a cafe owner. Oh, no, he's wearing dungarees or something and a neckerchief, and he's in a cafe. I've also,
okay.
Yeah.
He's a baker.
There we go. I just needed a candlestick maker, and then we've got all those covered. Carry.
I didn't remember I had that up there. Yeah, I did that. And in New York, I was making for this wonderful sort of adult toy store named the Enchanted Forest, which no longer exists. I made dolls that were sort of anthropomorphized animals, mm-hmm. you know, animals wearing human clothes, and they all had their quirky faces. So that it was all, those were all kind of not very much money making projects, but I think they all sort of stuck in my psyche and affected what happened later on with the especially the 3D artwork.
They're all steps in the same direction, aren't they? What was I gonna say? And then, because what occurred to me just now, you're just talking about the marionettes, and it's weird actually, but like your sculptures and your statues are very stationary, and it sort of surprises me that you've not considered an animation element to it. It feels like there may be something there that's, you know, another further step, because stop motion animation with your kind of characters feels like something that could be very rewarding.
I would love to do that. I would love to do that. It's a question of time.
Yeah, slightly. It's like the most time consuming.
I do. I have, it's not animation, but I do have a series of work that kind of extends the lives of these characters and their stories in Photoshop.
Right.
So I can take pictures, you know, I take photos of them. Mm-hmm. And import them into Photoshop and cut them out and then put them in new backgrounds.
Right.
And mix them up, you know, and tell new stories that way.
Mm.
And that's a lot of fun. I really enjoy doing that. But stop motion animation, definitely.
I mean, I'm just putting that out there. We'll come back in like 5 years' time. You'd be like, that's killed me, that I like the most time consuming possible of all the but yeah, it's interesting, like you're saying, with the marionettes and that kind of thing as well, because there's just that, yeah, just putting the energy, there's so much like play in your characters, there's so much sort of, that's where I feel like you've got these snapshots, and it does, I mean, does each of your pieces come with a story attached to it, then you're able to say this is what's going on, or do you just kind of put them there and let people work it out for themselves?
There's a bit of both aspects. Usually when I get an idea, it's just kind of a flash.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be, you know, it can arise from some technical thing. Like I remember once I lived in an apartment in Paris with a really small workspace. So I had stuff all over the floor. And I looked down and there were a couple of pieces of paper on the floor, torn pieces of paper, and they were kind of intersecting at one point. And I thought, wow, that looks really cool. And that kind of gave me the idea for the different layers in my paintings subsequently. So ideas can come from that kind of resource, or it can be an idea from something I've seen, or an idea that comes from a phrase maybe, but it's not fleshed out. And then later on, I have to, you know, I'll make like a rough sketch, nothing detailed. And then on, you know, the work involves kind of fleshing things out and dealing with the challenges and what is it actually going to look like? And oh my God, what, you know, which colors should I use? And making lots and lots of mistakes along the way and then dealing with them anyway and pushing it forward until it works. Sometimes they work quickly, but a lot of times it's a slower process. So I don't know if I actually have a full story, a bit of a background. I do steal, I think, like many artists, I steal ideas from other people's work and other things, a lot of things I've seen over the years in museums.
Do they cross-reference? Like, do you, because you've got a lot of pieces that have this sort of similar aesthetic, and I observe, particularly in the work you've shared with me, lots of big characters and little characters. That seems to be a thing as well. Like, are there now, it's just making me think of, like, I don't know, like superhero comics. And now when they wrote the comics in the 60s, they were just making it all up. And now it's like 50 years later that there's a whole canon that has to be respected. And I wonder whether, do you have a bit of a canon in your storytelling now? There are certain rules that ought to be applied because they're fitting into this whole, or are they all just individual stories and they could go any direction you like?
That's a good question. I think some of them fit the latter category. Mm. And then some of them actually are an assemblage on a theme.
Mm.
Like that there's a whole series you may have seen, both 3D and the flatter paintings on Couldn't We Have All Tried to Get Along.
Right.
So that in that respect, I had I don't know if you would call it a story, it's more like an anxiety that I wanted to deal with about how the, you know, we as humans are really not doing a good job protecting our planet, you know, treating our planet well, treating other species well, treating each other well.
Mm.
And so I kind of invented my own class of extinct species, both animal and humanoid, in an ideal world used to get along, and maybe they no longer exist. And, you know, why did we not do something about this until it was too late? So that's, there's several pieces that apply to that theme. And for that, I kind of went grab bagging around in different places. Like in France, there are all these amazing local museums in small towns. And usually they have, you know, they have collections of all kinds of local cultural artifacts and, you know, farm tools, and I don't know, they reconstruct old classrooms, and then they'll have a natural history component, and you see all these dusty taxidermy, you know, slightly wobbly, wonky, as you say, animals, and some of which are extinct. And so I got a lot of ideas from that kind of place. And also I do love folk art. And from all over the place. So I picked up a lot of, I mean, the imagination in these different cultures of folk art is just mind blowing. So like people sometimes ask me where my imagination comes from. And for me, it's simple. It comes from other people that have done these amazing things before me. So I'll take aspects of that and import it into the work too, because that's another another aspect of life that we're not very, that we're not protecting.